Good morning. It's our Tech Update Monday on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with us, Beth D'Angelo. She's worked in information technology for more than 20 years now as a senior IT specialist at UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, otherwise known as DOIT. And we're going to start today with taking a look at your home Wi-Fi, what it is, how to best set it up, get the best signal. And we'll take a look at the web browsers that are available to surf the web and find out the best one for you. And along the way, answering all of your tech questions from the basic to the advanced. What do you need to know to be safe online and to get around online, which is where I feel like increasingly everything is? You can ask your questions, make your comments. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at any time to talk@WPR.org. And Beth, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me.
And let's start with, I guess, a little trivia question here.
What
does Wi-Fi stand for? I can get the wireless part of Wi-Fi. I think I'm pretty sure of that. But the Fi part is what?
I think it's wide fidelity. It's talking about a wide band signal. So do you remember back in the days of Hi-Fi?
Yes.
High fidelity.
So I didn't even get the wireless part right. Why is fidelity?
I believe so. It's wireless fidelity. You're correct. It is wireless fidelity, not wide, but wireless fidelity.
Didn't want to go 0-for-2 right out of the gate this morning.
Wireless fidelity. Yeah.
So, and you know, this has been around for I feel like it's been around for a long time now, like 20 years, which would be a lifetime for technology these days. But how has it advanced in the 20 years that you've been in information technology, Beth?
Well, certainly the consistency and strength of signals has increased over time. The distance that the wireless signals can actually travel, the amount of data that can be transmitted via wireless signals has improved. And then the security around how wireless data is transmitted has really come leaps and bounds.
So when we're talking about Wi-Fi, we're sending these data packets from the internet and from our computer back and forth through the air. How easily can they be intercepted?
Well, it's a radio signal. So without layers of security around that radio frequency wave, it's pretty easy to intercept with the right tools. But one of those major improvements in Wi-Fi has been the encryption that's been built into the devices that are transmitting those signals, so that if the signal is captured, it can't be decoded without very advanced decryption tools.
So, Beth, when I go to connect to a Wi-Fi signal, I always see the padlock or no padlock next to the options there. And the padlock would require a password, and a non-padlock, well, that's just easier to connect to. But what are some of the pros and cons of going from that padlocked wireless connection to the unsecure one?
Yeah, so if you have one that's open, that means it's a public-facing access point. That means anyone can connect to that Wi-Fi router if they're in proximity to it. If they're close enough, they can make a connection to it, which means they are then sharing a network space with every other device that is connected to that Wi-Fi system. So if your system is connected to the same public-facing Wi-Fi as someone who may want to try to get into hack your computer or steal data or, any other nefarious activity, you're not going to be protected because just about anybody who's in proximity to that device will be able to connect to the same network.
So restaurants, doctor's offices, and just about any place you go can have an opportunity for a open, insecure wireless connection. How safe should I be, and what are the best practices when using those connections, Beth?
Yeah, so generally, if I'm on public Wi-Fi, I'm going to be pretty judicious about what I'm doing on my device. So likely, I'm not going to be opening any of my banking apps, opening my personal health data apps, or transmitting anything that could be sensitive or secure information. So I'm pretty careful about when I will connect to an open Wi-Fi signal or a guest Wi-Fi network that's not secured, and really depending on where it is and how many people would have access to it, you just have to be pretty judicious about it. And then also making sure you have the device that you're connecting with has some security built into it. So antivirus protection, if you're really concerned, setting up a VPN on your device will protect your traffic when you're connected to a public-facing Wi-Fi network. So that's another tool you can use. Or just ensuring that all of your applications on your device are password protected with a strong password.
All right, our second trivia question of the day. VPN stands for Virtual Private Network?
That's it. You got it.
I need a ding, ding, ding for getting one right here today.
We need a buzzer for the winner.
But that virtual private network operates in what way, and what's the, what's the purpose of it?
So the way I like to think about it is like a tunnel. Essentially what you're doing is you're connecting to a Wi-Fi network that's open to the public where if you don't have some sort of VPN turned on your device while you're doing that, that signal is interceptable. It's not encrypted. It's easy to intercept with specific types of devices. It could be used for nefarious purposes. If you are using a VPN, you're creating a tunnel within that network that you're connecting to. So let's say that the Wi-Fi network is a large pipe of information that's traveling that anybody can poke a hole into and get access to the data that's traveling through it. But the VPN creates a tunnel inside that pipe that encapsulates your data that you're sending and receiving with encryption and makes it not penetrable like the open pipe would be.
When does Beth D'Angelo use a virtual private network or VPN?
Well, I'll use it actually in a bunch of different use cases. One of the most interesting ways I use it is when I'm searching for travel, when I want to buy a plane ticket online.
And why is that?
A lot of the services that you would buy, plane tickets or rent cars or hotel rooms through, they are tracking where you are searching from. So they're using various devices within your browser that allow them to know who is searching for this service they want to purchase or this plane ticket they want to purchase. They will track how many times you've looked for the same ticket. They'll know that you have a demand for it. Huh. And every time you look for it, you're going to get a different price. And the price is going to keep going up and up and up. But if you turn on a VPN while you're searching, they won't be able to see who it is and where they're coming from looking at that specific search stream. So they're not tracking you. They don't know it's you. They're not going to keep upping the price every time you look at it.
Well, I'll be darned. Okay, that seems like it's worth its weight in whatever software is required. But is this something I should pay?
Yeah, real hot tip.
Yeah, no kidding. That could save us some money. But is that something I should be paying money for, a virtual private network? Are there free ones that would work just as well? Where would I go to find the best VPN, Beth?
Yeah, there are free VPN services that you can download for your device. They're good for short-term use, once-in-a-while use. A lot of them have ads or a wait time or aren't quite as reliable as the paid versions. But what I usually recommend is if people are already purchasing a security suite for their device, like antivirus and anti-malware and firewall protection, through something like Norton 360 or McAfee or one of the other major services, generally those come with a VPN that's provided as part of that package. So you can go ahead and use the VPN service that comes with that you're already paying for.
And which devices would I want to use the VPN and these security software security packages on? All of them?
All of them. Yeah. And generally they're subscription-based. So you pay for a yearly subscription, and it will cover up to a certain number of devices.
Okay. and they may just save you enough money on travel alone to make them worth their while. So that is a great tip. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, otherwise known as DOIT, on the UW-Madison campus. And we're inviting you to our tech update today with your tech questions, whether they are basic or advanced, at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Amy in Iola next. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I run an Airbnb, and I need to set up a guest network, I guess, so that I keep my information private.
Oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We talked about connecting to an open or unsecure public network, but what about when you need to share your home personal network, like Amy does, with visitors, strangers, or even friends or family, Beth?
Yeah, that is a great idea. And I would highly recommend, if you have Wi-Fi in your home and you expect that there are people going to be using your Wi-Fi and you don't want them to have direct access to the same network all of your devices are on, the Wi-Fi router that you're using for your signal currently has an interface that you can get to through a web browser. And within that management interface, that tool that comes with it, you'll be able to create a guest network that you can password protect or leave open as an unsecure public network that isolates that traffic from the network that you use for your devices. So you can create a separate segregated space that doesn't intersect on that device that'll keep that traffic private.
So there is a web portal, a website that connects to your router that will allow you to change the settings on your router that would allow you to separate your home and personal network from a guest or visitor network.
Correct. So if you want to find that interface, the easiest way to do that is to just do a search for the model of router that you're using with the term admin portal or administrative portal. And it'll tell you how to get to that web page for your specific device and how to set up that guest network.
Those portals, as I have seen in the past, Beth, might also require a login and password. They might also not. Would you recommend a login and pass for that portal to your router?
Absolutely, 100%. That is a great question. So most of those routers come with a default username and password.
Like admin or something like that.
It's usually admin or admin or blank and admin or admin and default, but it's very easy to figure out because they're pretty much all the same depending on the manufacturer. And if somebody hasn't changed that password, somebody not even in your home, but somebody who can see your Wi-Fi signal outside your home could connect to your router. If you haven't changed that password, they put in what they know as the default. They have access to your router. They have access to your home network and every device that's on it. So I always change that. That's the first thing I do when I set up a new router, is change that admin password.
Well, and Beth D'Angelo, as we started the conversation, our Wi-Fi has gotten stronger. It has gotten more secure. There are more options, and it stretches further than the old wireless routers have in the past. At what point do you consider updating your router to the latest version or a more powerful version?
Yeah, I think if you're seeing your Wi-Fi signal dropping frequently or things seem to be slowing down, often that type of behavior can be fixed by just rebooting your router. A lot of people don't do that very often. And if there's some sort of, bottleneck going on within the device, rebooting it oftentimes will clear that up. Or if you're dropping your connection frequently, it suddenly stops working and then starts working again 2 minutes later, usually a reboot will fix that. But if that's happening more often and a reboot's not fixing it, or you find that your Wi-Fi signal isn't reaching all parts of your home, or you're just not getting the signal strength that you need to be able to stream video, on the other side of your house, oftentimes that's a good opportunity to upgrade to something a little stronger, a little newer, or with better coverage.
Some people rent their routers from their internet service provider. Would it still be a possibility of making those changes in the portal to the administrative settings, even if you're renting your router from an ISP?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Same. You should be able to access it like when you purchased. And then even if you do, so I got my internet service comes with a router, and then I bought my own Wi-Fi router to connect to that internet access point, so that I had a little bit more control over my home network and a bit more powerful router. So basically I chained the two together, and I use one for my internet coming into my house. And then my device that I purchased on my own takes that connection and distributes it out to my house.
Beth D'Angelo back with us today, Senior IT Specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. If you have questions about your cell phone, computer, or even connecting your smart TV, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org. Kyle, we'll get to you in 1 minute. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and this is WPR News. It's the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry, and stay with us because afternoon today we take a look at the historic record beneath our feet and what the fossils of Wisconsin tell us about our own ancient history. Don McCullough, curator at the Weiss Earth Science Museum, our guest. Right now, Beth D'Angelo sharing what we need to know about keeping ourselves safe online, how to use the Wi-Fi and employ the VPN, which is the Virtual Private Network. Kyle and Winnicani has a question about using a VPN. We'll go there next. Good morning, Kyle.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question. What you're talking about, it was kind of tracking, like, would the demographic area where your VPN make a difference? Where if I go to a VPN in Palo Alto versus like a VPN in Huntsville, Alabama, where Palo Alto is more expensive generally. So I was wondering if you get a different price based on something like that.
Interesting question. And I've seen this come up too on VPNs where you can connect with what would seem to be something that is across the country or even around the world, Beth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That does happen based on where your actual location is in the world. Prices may change when you're searching for something online because that site that you're searching through knows where you are in the world and where you are searching from. So here's an anecdote. Searching for international travel to fly, let's say, from Chicago to Rome. If I search from here, from where I'm at, not using a VPN, for a flight from Chicago to Rome, I'm going to get one price. And if I connect to a VPN that says I'm in Italy and I look for the same ticket, it's going to be less. So it really does matter where the website thinks you're coming from. If you're looking at something that has a very variable pricing structure like travel, where the cost can change based on so many different variables and algorithms, you know, there are a lot of ways to kind of game the system.
So when you're shopping around, do you just shop around from different VPN locations?
It really depends on what I'm shopping for. So
okay.
Yeah, especially with travel. And then another interesting thing. So streaming services like Netflix, they have certain titles available depending on where you are in the world. So while something might be licensed for you to view while you're in the United States, if you're in a different country and you want to view that same thing, you won't be able to if you're connected to the internet in that other country. You can connect to your VPN and look like you're coming from the U.S. and that same content will then be available to you on Netflix.
Hey, Kyle, does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thank you guys very much. A great answer. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for asking it, Kyle. I appreciate that. Beth, we talked a little bit about updating your router and when's the best time to do that in order to get more features and more signal strength. But what if you just wanted to extend the signal strength of your Wi-Fi in your home without purchasing a new router? What's the best way to go about that?
Yeah, I generally recommend that people look at something called mesh Wi-Fi, which is essentially creating like a wider net within your home that carries that signal. So what mesh Wi-Fi can do is take your existing internet signal and kind of boost that out to further distances and give a stronger signal in a larger area of your home.
Do they have extenders as well, and would those be as effective?
Yeah, there are. So you can get Wi-Fi extenders or signal boosters. I've found some to be a little bit more effective than others.
Yeah.
But really, mesh Wi-Fi is a more comprehensive way of distributing the signal than just a booster. So it tends to be a bit more reliable, and there's fewer gaps in coverage with that.
The one we use in our building complex is Eero by Amazon, E-E-R-O, mm-hmm. and we set up mm-hmm. three of them, and we're able to have, share internet among a number of us inside the house. So I found that, very useful, and the signal strength has been very strong. I want to double back to something you had mentioned earlier that comes up on a regular basis with our mm-hmm. IT department here at WPR, and it is the valuable power of the reboot and how often that can solve a problem when you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be a technical snafu that I won't be able to solve. And then the IT guy comes in and said, well, did you try to unplug it and plug it back in? And how often that becomes a solution still boggles my mind, Beth.
And, really, honestly, to the point where it's a running joke amongst my colleagues and myself that it doesn't matter what the thing is that someone is mentioning has a problem, that one of us will inevitably say, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again? Which, inevitably leads to groans and laughter and, eye rolling. But I wish I had a nickel for every time I've said that to someone when they ask me, what's wrong with this? I say, well, have you tried turning it off and turning it back on again? And I don't mean to say seem patronizing or condescending when I say it. Really, 95% of the time when you're dealing with any type of electronic device, shutting it down fully, waiting 10, 15 seconds, turning it back on, letting it fully power back on will likely resolve your problem.
Why? What is it that makes it stop and then start and work again?
We could be here all day talking about that. is the why really as important is that it just works.
as far as IT goes, that's about as much as you need to know. And I found that more often than not, and I still find it funny today. Every time they say, well, have you tried unplugging it and plugging it back in? Yeah, that seems to do the trick. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, senior IT specialist for UW-Madison's Do It. That's the Division of Information Technology, answering your tech questions today from the basic to the advanced at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@WPR.org. Now, more often than not, when we're connecting to the internet, Beth, we're using a web browser, but not all web browsers are created equal. And I'm wondering how an IT specialist sees which browser to use and why.
Yeah, well, a couple of different factors will weigh in on which browser you choose. First being, what kind of device are you on? Are you on an Apple device? Are you on a Windows device? Are you on an Android device? Most of those come with a browser built into the operating system. So if we talk about something like a PC, your basic laptop with Windows loaded on it, that's going to come with Microsoft Edge, which is their built-in browser. It's decent. Personally, I don't use it. I prefer to use Chrome when I'm working on a Windows machine. Mm-hmm. The Apple platform or Macintosh comes with Safari as its built-in web browser, and that's the same on a mobile device like an iPhone or an iPad. It's going to come with Safari. So Google devices, so an Android device is going to come with Chrome built into it. And Chrome is my preferred browser as an easy use on any device. But if I'm looking for more security or more privacy or less tracking of my internet activity, then I look to a browser called DuckDuckGo, which is a little less known. It's not one of the big ones that's more well known, but has a lot more privacy and security built into it and is a favorite of IT folks like myself.
That's DuckDuckGo?
DuckDuckGo.
The one that I thought was more secure than the pre-installed options that come with an Android or an Apple or a Microsoft computer or phone was the Firefox from Mozilla.
Yeah, Firefox is also a great option. I used Firefox for years until I really started getting more involved with DuckDuckGo and using that more, because it is definitely a more secure browser than what is installed at, by default on an operating system.
And when you mean also, more secure, Beth, what do you mean by that?
Well, they're tracking less because Firefox isn't tied to a company like Google or Microsoft, mm-hmm. which is collecting your data in order to sell to other vendors to use for targeted advertising. So it's a little bit more independent, and you're going to see a higher level of privacy and more ability to manipulate your privacy settings within Firefox.
Okay, but you've made the jump from Firefox now to DuckDuckGo as a web browser because you found that more secure. Is it just more security options? Is it less tracking, less pop-ups? That's something that I'm always looking for.
What I like about DuckDuckGo is it's not tracking your activity in order to serve you personalized ads.
Okay.
So they're not relying on that for revenue to support their business. So they're not looking at the consumers of the product as the actual product, which a lot of the other browser providers kind of, the people who are using the browser are actually the product, not the browser itself.
Now, most of these browsers have the options of plugins where you can grab little software mm-hmm. that would add or subtract to your web browsing experience. What should we look for when it comes to these plugins to our browsers and some of the dangers they might provide and some of the benefits they might have?
Yeah, so those are becoming more and more prevalent now, especially with all of the new AI gizmos and doodads that are becoming companions to browser applications. I would be very cautious about add-ins and take a look at the data that they access and the data that they share before installing one to work with my browser. So I'd take a look at the privacy settings that you can manipulate within that tool. I would look at any of their policy on data collection and data sharing. And I would look at the various types of tools that they use for collecting that data, whether or not they're using cookies or link tracking or various things that sometimes can behave like malware.
So read the fine print on this. The terms and conditions may be worth not just browsing through, but scouring to make sure that what you're adding isn't taking away from your privacy online, security online, and your experience online.
Exactly.
Thank you. Beth D'Angelo, our guest, and taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Jim in Wausau next. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about the changes that happened a few months ago to Yahoo Mail, supposed improvements that seem to me to have made it much more difficult to use.
What was the experience?
Well, they added supposed artificial intelligence summary to the emails, but that has now disguised the actual email address of the sender. So you can't tell the obvious scams by the funny email addresses.
Sure.
I discovered that if you go to the option to block sender, they do show the actual address. But it doesn't really pay to block the sender because they keep changing those addresses regularly. But at least you can confirm that. But the other irritating change is it's now difficult to send emails to the archive. That's not an option under Move, and I'm wondering if anyone may know how you get around it. I'm pretty sure there'd be an escape for that.
I would like to think so, Jim, and sometimes these advancements aren't necessarily to the benefit of the user. And Beth, what do you know about changes to Yahoo Mail, integrating AI into mail, and protecting us against some of the fraudsters that enter our inbox?
Yeah, it seems like all of the mail providers now are starting to build AI into their interfaces to quote-unquote help you. and I think often we find some of these features a little bit more like they get in the way than they assist us with what we're trying to do. And oftentimes it's helpful to switch back to the classic interface of something rather than to use the new version until you're more familiar with, you know, how the new features work and how you can work them into your processes for using the tool. I know Yahoo does allow an option to switch back to the classic view if you don't like the new version of it and you don't want to see it that way, or you're having trouble finding some of the features that you used to use and you want to go back to being able to do that. If you go into your account settings within your Yahoo Mail, there is an option under the little gear icon that allows you to switch it back to the classic view so you can see that old version of it again. I'll warn you that likely at some point that classic version will go away. So if there are features that you're not able to find in the new version, I would do a quick search in Google about, you know, how do I find this setting in the new view of Yahoo Mail, and likely it'll give you instructions on where that is.
Well, let me ask you about this, Beth, because you mentioned Googling something to figure it out. And Jim, I'm sure that if you're having a problem with Yahoo Mail, there are others like you, and you will find solutions or at least workarounds online by searching for the same problems that you're having. But if you've moved to the DuckDuckGo web browser, how come you haven't moved to the DuckDuckGo web search, Beth?
I still do Google quite a bit, you know, especially if I'm like asking like a crowdsource question.
Okay.
You know, if I want like the largest group of people to weigh in on what I'm trying to figure out, and I want to take a diverse set of opinions and try to distill that into my own version of what I want to try next, reaching out to a wider audience through something like Google, it's going to give you a lot more data to pull from in order to come up with an answer. So as far as like getting more data points, something like Google is definitely a powerful tool because of all of the history behind it and all of the data collection that they have done. But for like how-tos, or if I'm trying to ask a question or crowdsource information, I've actually found Reddit to be an awesome tool for that.
Oh, nice.
You gotta be careful about where you ask. So often somebody's already asked the question that you're asking, and you can find hundreds of answers that'll lead you to the right choice.
Reddit.com has forums for just about everyone and everything. But yeah, buyer beware when you go in there, and make sure that the answers you're getting seem to be at least substantiated by others inside that forum who have had similar experiences. And the other thing about searching on Google, using Google as a search, that I've found is I tend to want to scroll past the sponsored responses or answers before I get to something that I'd feel confident about.
Yeah, that's another good point. Google is also, you know, if you have, like I use Google in my Chrome web browser sometimes, and the combination of those two generates an AI overview of your search results. Be careful when looking at those AI overviews. The accuracy is questionable. the AI has a tendency to... Sometimes we call it hallucinating.
Yeah, but why do they call it hallucinating when it's just getting it wrong?
Well, because it thinks it's right.
it doesn't matter if it thinks it's right. It is inaccurate information. It is wrong. It is false. And calling it a hallucination is, I don't think, accurate, or at least as precise as it could be when you're just talking about AI as it continues to artificial intelligence as it continues to develop what it knows, revealing itself to not know so much in some places still.
Maybe they call it hallucinating because sometimes the return results are real weird.
Yeah, well, that does make sense. But speaking about Google and Chrome and ads, let's go to Esty in Madison next. Esty, good morning.
Good morning. I just want to add to what you guys were just discussing before I ask my question. I have used DuckDuckGo. I nowadays use Brave, which is another one like it. And both of them are just, in my opinion, terrible. When you need to search for someone, I always end up going to Google for that.
Okay.
But, you know, that's not a very big price to pay, right? to keep your privacy. So, but my question is, the last time that I upgraded to Chrome, what started happening is pretty much every third time that I ask Google for something, instead of answering, it sends me to a page that is an ad. It's not it's not just the advertising page that we're used to, but it's an ad. And that seemed very strange and suspicious.
Esty, can I ask you, do you have antivirus software or some security software on your computer? Have you run a scan for antivirus on there?
That's a very good question. No, I have not done that. But I did uninstall it and then reinstalled, and it's still doing the same. So I wonder if you'll guess, what do you think might be going on there?
Great question, Esty, and thank you for calling. And Beth, what do you think is going on there?
Yeah, so I think that... most of the results that you're seeing on the first page of your search are going to be sponsored results at this point because of, Google's revenue streams. They're promoting more and more sponsored content than they had previously. And I think with the newer versions of Chrome, often the results that you're seeing are not, it's actually changing the search string in order to allow the browser to return more sponsored results to you rather than the most correlated or most relevant results.
Well, that doesn't sound like something I would... That doesn't sound like it benefits the user as much as it benefits those who are paying to be seen by Google.
Correct.
Yeah.
Definitely a benefit to Google's revenue stream.
So, I that would be a tough one when deciding what to search for if all you're getting on your Chrome web browser. Maybe you try the DuckDuckGo web browser and then use the Google search?
Yeah. Actually, we'll just skip to the second page of Google search results if I start with that.
Oh, interesting. All right. So there's a combination to try, Esty, and thank you for your question. Let's go to Tree in Montello next. Tree, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What's your question?
I just want to know how to stop pop-ups on my phone. I'll be trying to Google something or trying to, call someone, and all of a sudden something will pop up and I have to exit out or, try to get rid of it before I can continue. And then another one will show up.
What kind of phone do you have, Tree?
I have a Samsung iPhone or Android?
Oh, it's Android. Okay. So because it might be different experiences depending on the actual cell phone and the software inside it. And you can't see me right now, Tree, but I am shaking my fist in the air at those pop-up ads that come up on my cell phone. And I have to have a very precise little finger to make sure that the pop-up ad goes away and I don't accidentally click into another ad that takes me somewhere away from what I was trying to look for in the first place. Are there ways to get rid of these pop-up ads on Android or iPhones, Beth?
Yeah, absolutely. So specific to Android, there's a couple different ways you can do this. If it's a specific application that's throwing pop-ups, you can disable the notifications for that application by going into the settings and then apps section. And there should be a notifications option within those settings. So that's specific to an application.
Okay.
But if it's an app overlay that's popping up, you can go into those settings again, and then there's a section called special access. And if you go into that special access section, you can turn off the appear on top function that will disable any of those overlays from popping up over the top of the application you have open. And then you can also adjust the settings in the browser that you're using. So if it's Chrome or Firefox, you can go into the settings. And if you go into site settings, you can turn off the pop-ups and redirects toggle.
And would it be worth experimenting with different web browsers on a cell phone to see what provides the best experience and minimizes those pop-up ads, Beth?
Yeah, I think that can definitely be a way to minimize those. If you experiment with various different browser applications and one of them seems to do less of that than others. But within these settings, you should be able to turn it off for any browser that you're using. So hopefully then one wouldn't be better than the other. It just won't happen with any of them.
Tree, thank you for the call, because you had the same question I had for our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist for UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. otherwise known as Do It. Your questions, we've still got time, 1-800-642-1234. What tech questions do you have for our guest? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry today, and you're listening to WPR News. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show. Larry's back tomorrow with a look at the first ever blood test to show Alzheimer's disease. Then we'll find out how to best talk to someone who has dementia. And in the last hour, how to take care of your mouth, the best techniques in oral hygiene. All coming up tomorrow with Larry on The Larry Mueller Show. Right now, it's our Tech Update Monday with Beth D'Angelo, Senior IT Specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. And Beth, earlier we were talking about the importance of seeing that padlock when making a Wi-Fi connection. But I also see padlocks when it comes to browsing websites in the web browser. What does that padlock mean, and how should I view those web addresses and what I see in what my web address bar in terms of staying safe?
Yeah, that little lock icon, it refers to something called SSL, or Secure Socket Layer, which nobody needs to know about.
Okay.
But what it essentially means is that the website that you are connecting to, or the website that you are browsing to, has additional security built into it, into the code of the website, that encrypts the data that you transmit through that site. So it's telling you that this is a secure website and not an open website without encryption.
So that's a website where I could put my personal information, my credit card number, health data. And when I do not see that padlock, should I abstain from putting in my personal information, my credit card number, and my health data?
100%. Any legitimate business or organization that is collecting that information will have taken the steps to secure their web presence in order to collect that data from you. There are actually federal regulations that require it. For collecting certain types of data for certain businesses.
Beth, what about when I look in the address bar of my web browser and I see addresses that start with HTTP or HTTPS? Is there a difference between the two?
That is the same thing.
Okay.
The HTTP is an unsecure, non-encrypted text website. Doesn't have those additional layers of encryption or security around it. HTTPS is the secure version of that code that includes that type of encryption.
That is good to know. Let's go back to your questions now with our guest, Beth D'Angelo, Curtin, Columbia County. You're next. Good morning.
Good morning. Good information. I'd like Beth to compare two upgrades I'm considering. The first, I still have a landline from the local phone company with a bandwidth of 2. They say they can upgrade it to about 10 by having people come into the house and rewire, versus what you folks have been talking the last hour about wireless at, say, DuckDuckGo or Spectrum to get a higher bandwidth so I can stream. What do you think?
Those are, I am glad you called, Kurt and Beth. So you can update the upgrade the landline, or those aren't necessarily two different things, are they?
Yeah, I'll give a little bit of explanation. So it sounds like you've got currently a broadband internet connection that runs about 2 megabits per second for your speed, and you have the opportunity to either have that rewired to your home to get 10 megabits per second download speed, or to switch to a different provider to get a higher download speed. And if that's what we're thinking about, just really one thing to keep in mind, if you're looking at streaming video, a good rule of thumb is that you want at least 6 megabits per second to be able to stream video without buffering at a high resolution. So at 2 megabits per second right now, you're going to have a lot of problems. If you can upgrade to 10 with your current, you know, setup, and they just need to rewire it to your home, I don't believe there should be any cost to you to upgrade the lines coming to your home. But if it's something within your home that needs to be changed, You may want to look at having that 10 megabit connection brought into your house and then getting a router that will support that higher speed of Wi-Fi to your devices.
So it might be a cost issue and probably something to look into in terms of the bottom line, but when it comes to streaming, which is what many of us use internet for, 6 megabytes per second is about the bare minimum?
Yeah, that's really what you want for a stable connection without having the, you know, the video buffering all the time or, you know, having it be choppy or stopping and starting or coming in at a lower resolution than it's supposed to.
Hey, I got an email from Steve here who would like you to suggest a router brand for him. Is there one that comes to mind, Beth?
I have a Netgear router.
Okay.
I believe Netgear was purchased by Cisco, so it's now Cisco branded. The one that I use is called a Nighthawk. It's excellent. It reaches my whole house, yard, property very well.
Nighthawk.
Nighthawk. I bought it a couple of years ago. I think it was maybe, it was under $300 at the time.
Oh, nice.
It probably come down in price since then. If you're just covering a normal size home, you shouldn't need to purchase anything extraordinary.
Otto emailed. He says he uses the Opera web browser and downloading it and automatically blocks all pop-ups. And he also has a VPN, virtual private network, and he doesn't have to do anything else. That's good information, Otto. I appreciate that. Let's go next to Steve in Ironwood, Michigan, who has a question for our guest, Beth D'Angelo. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. I've got a desktop. I've had the same email address for 20 years, and I used to get 3-4 spams a week. Now I'm getting 100 and since the first of the year. A lot of them have politicians' name on them. I won't mention politicians' name, but...
Well, I appreciate that, Steve, but this inundation of spam, I am sure you are not alone in that regard. And what can he do with his inbox or, for that matter, maybe his internet service provider? He's with Charter, Beth. Is there a way to go to get back what he lost in terms of a clean inbox?
Yeah, I know. Spam is like the bane of our existence. In my world of IT, we fight spam every day. But it's not going away. So we have to find better ways to kind of filter it out. There are a couple of different things you can do. So if it's stuff that's already coming into you and it's not something that you can like set up ahead of time to prevent it from starting in the first place, there usually are, depending on who your email provider is, ways to report that address to your provider as a spammer. So usually there's a tool either built into the web interface that you use for checking your email where you can, select a message and check a box that says this is spam.
Mm-hmm.
And that will actually train the spam filters that your provider is using to filter that out in the future. So you can help prevent future spam from coming by being diligent about anytime you see one, just report it and block it. And eventually those spam filters learn that this is not a valid sender and they'll block it for you and it'll never come to your email. The other thing you can do, this is something that I've done for years. Once spam started to become a really prevalent problem, I created a second email account that I only use for signing up for things.
Oh.
If I need to create an account that requires an email address, if I need to, if I'm going to get a rewards card at the grocery store and they need my email address for it, I'm going to give them this email address. And it's not the one I use for my personal correspondence. It's not my work address. It's not my personal address. It's basically a dummy address that I use. Then if they're going to start selling that information to other people to spam me or they're going to be spamming me, they're going to spam that account that I don't care about. I'm not going to look at it. It's not going to gum up my inbox that I use every day.
Do you ever use the unsubscribe link that is often found at the bottom of these spam emails? And is it effective? I've only got about 30 seconds, Beth.
Yeah, they can be effective, but I've also found a service called Unsubscribe Me.
Oh.
Unsubscribe.me is a great service for scouring where you are subscribed and unsubscribing you.
Beth D'Angelo, you are a great service. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
Beth D'Angelo is a senior IT specialist with UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology. Stay with us because next we'll look at the ancient history that lies beneath our feet and the story it tells. And then also this next hour, we'll take a look at the evolution of human evolution. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to WPR News.